Welcome to PPM Simplifies. This is a weekly podcast that will help you have a better understanding on environmental regulations and how they relate to your industry. In each episode, we'll talk with experts across various industries who will share their insights with you. This is PPM Simplifies. And welcome to this week's episode of PPM Simplifies. This week, we're going to be discussing a hot topic. We're going to talk about PFAS Simplified. This is Todd Perry. I'm your host. And today, we're joined by Jared Satterfield, Project Engineer and Project Manager Extraordinaire with PPM Consultants. Jared, good day to you. How are you, sir?
Good, Todd. Thank you for having me today.
Man, we are so glad to have you with us and talk about this. And, you know, PFAS are a hot topic. We're hearing about it everywhere. We're hearing about it in the news, on social media, EPA, state regulations. Everyone's talking about it. So let's just take it from the top. What in the world is a PFAS? It sounds kind of cute.
So, Todd, PFAS, they are a group of man-made chemicals that include PFOA, PFOS, Gen X, and many other chemicals. They're a chain of carbon atoms surrounded by fluorine atoms with different endings. PFAS are synthetic chemicals, substances, which are special properties in hundreds of manufacturing and industrial applications.
So, you know, from there, they're very prevalent. They're used an awful lot. So what kind of items, what kind of products can we find PFAS contained in?
You know, they've been used in manufacturing in a variety of industries around the globe. United States has used them since the 1940s. They've been the most extensively produced and studied in this group. So, you know, they're really everywhere. So food containers, pizza boxes, fast food wrappers, cookware, your nonstick pans and pots, polishes, waxes, stain repellents for carpets, clothing, furniture, firefighting foams, and, you know, they're really in the public supply wells also.
So, yeah, I mean, it's obviously has good usage and benefits. And I guess science, as we've studied these different elements and chemicals, how many, aren't there thousands of unique PFAS out there, long chain hydrocarbons?
There are. They're the long chain, but recently they've started producing short chain. Also, so that was the agreement, was to go from a long chain to a short chain, which allows for a faster breakdown. But even the short chain, they're still forever chemicals.
And, you know, so now we've studied them and we're determining in some cases, at some doses, exposure levels, that they can be a risk.
They can. And so the predominant concerns of the PFAS is the health effects in humans, which includes the immune system, developmental or reproductive effects, liver damage, and hormonal responses.
And so, you know, this is new, it's cutting science. Would you say that PFAS have been maybe a developing area of regulatory concern over the last decade?
Yeah, they've really come into the spotlight over the last decade. As we said, that we've been using them for a long time, but as more research on the individual and collectively as a group, they have found concerns. And going back to those health risks, you know, certain effects such as increase in cholesterol, increase in uric acid, a decrease in birth weight, thyroid disease, diabetes, different types of cancer, and even just pregnancy-induced hypertension. So there's a lot of different areas that we're seeing.
And you used a word, forever chemical. And so they are hard to break down once they get out into the environment. The products that they are contained in break down, but these PFAS don't, and there's thousands of unique PFAS out there. Now, I've read a study. There's a environmental study group, and they come together and they test different, you know, chemicals looking for different risks. And on PFAS, I think seeing a they've detected it in 31 or more states now that in their water supply system, they can measure at a part per trillion of PFAS contamination.
So yeah, we're at the part per trillion. So historically, we've looked at different concentrations in parts per million. Then we got down to the parts per billion. And so, you know, a part per trillion, it's kind of hard to really quantify that. But, you know, that's like taking a dollar from $1,000.
Yeah.
And so when you break that out, you're talking a drop of water in a bucket.
Yeah. So you're saying if you had $1 trillion, you're going to have one part per trillion as a dollar out of that. And golly, that's just mind-boggling when you think about how insignificant, how small that is. That does. Now, I believe that I've read EPA right now, their advisory standard is 70 parts per trillion in drinking water. The good news is there are a few water systems that exceed that number. The majority of them, although they do have a detectable limit of PFAS, they're below that threshold of 70 parts per trillion.
That's correct.
I guess at this point, you know, it's a fairly new area. They're developing regulation. Nothing has been set in stone yet. What does the future look like? The near future look like? What will legislators do? Where will it come from? What are the trends in this area for the PFAS?
So, you know, regulation-wise, they're all over the board with trying to come together. Like you said, the 70 parts per trillion is one of the action levels they're looking at. The Biden administration, they've been real clear that environmental justice and equal economic opportunities are high on their list. And, you know, the clean drinking water is a high priority on that. And PFAS is known as a forever chemical, like we discussed. And so trying to evaluate the public supply wells and the different areas that we are actually accumulating that from, it takes time, but it is in the process.
Now, I believe that although we're looking for a national standard and most states will go there, there have been some states like New York, I believe they set the exposure level at even less than 70 parts per trillion. Their acceptable level is significantly less than that. So in your view, do you think that states will set health risk levels for PFAS even lower than the 70 part per trillion threshold that EPA is talking about?
I believe that the states that have historically set lower levels compared to what the EPA are going to follow the same trends, and that you will have different across, but the majority of your states are going to go with the EPA standard that they're setting, and that, you know, the PFAS, they're widespread, and the Biden administration has also alluded that PFAS may be included as a hazardous substance in the near future on their list.
And that would really complicate how you're going to, you know, remediate, mitigate, and assess and deal with PFAS contamination. I do know that our current EPA administrator that President Biden appointed came from North Carolina, and they actually set PFAS standards in their state. Because of the textile industry, they had a lot of the early detections occurred in the Carolinas. So I think that you've got, you know, a leader of EPA that is going to be committed to seeing this through and set some standards.
Definitely. And he is experienced with that because, like you said, in his state are some of the more widespread concentrations and some of the higher concentrations that they have found. And so he has been adequate there as far as getting that pushed forward. And I'm hoping that we'll see many of these coming forward.
So, you know, we talked about where you can find PFAS, what kind of products, what kind of industries have risk. And again, you talked about the original PFAS. I believe they were developed back in the 30s and 40s, and they were kind of a wartime use. And then we determined that, hey, this could be good for the consumers. And some of the products, you talked about the products there. But what kind of industries have to use PFAS in their processes and will be affected by, you know, potential regulations?
It's so widespread, Todd, that the industries, everything is going to be affected from, you know, the food industry for the packaging and even growing of the components that they use in their food in PFAS contaminated soil. You have commercial household products, the fabric repellents, polishes, wax, paints, and cleaning products, then manufacturing facilities with chrome plating, electronics, petroleum refineries and terminals, and drinking water suppliers. So just for an example, take a petroleum refinery and terminal. Historically, if they had a fire breakout at their facility and used a firefighting foam, that can retroact back, and the PFAS that were used in that firefighting foam, that can cause a problem going forward if they have to sample around their facility. And so there's limitless to what we're looking at as far as what we could counteract back to.
And as you use a product like that, it gets into stormwater. And we know that once, you know, PFAS comes in contact with water, it's highly soluble. So it goes in a solution very quickly, low vapor pressure. So, you know, once it hits water, it disperses really quickly. And then when you're thinking through your part per trillion thresholds, it doesn't take very much to contaminate an awful lot of water.
That's right. And with it accumulating throughout these processes, the wastewater treatment plants are also going to have some impacts from this, and landfills, because we have things that have been disposed of there for years that haven't been considered a risk that could be considered in the future. And so future requirements for sampling of discharges for PFAS are a high likelihood that are upcoming in our near future.
Well, I tell you, that is a very large impact, and it's going to be very interesting how it develops. So one other area I'd like to take you today is, we've talked about the risk, we talk about the potential regulations and some of the thresholds that some of the states are working under. How can you remediate PFAS? If you get PFAS in soil or groundwater and media associated near your manufacturing plant or in a water system, how can you clean this up?
So, you know, a lot of our historical technologies that we've used for other type of contamination, we can use with the PFAS as well. So the excavation and disposal, that's going to be our first route, because we can quickly remediate the area. However, a con to that is that all it's doing is relocating PFAS. And finding an adequate landfill for these can be a problem, because the liners have to be approved, the area has to be approved, groundwater runoff, and this different in those areas. So that's going to be the first to look at. Sorption and stabilization, that's going to be addition of different substances to the soil to treat it in place. You can take carbon and other minerals and apply that to where they are in the ground. But yet again, we're not removing the PFAS, we're not destroying them, and so they're still located there. So there's a concern with that, but it does kind of keeps it in one area, and so we don't have migration of it then. Some of the other technologies looking at is a thermal, and so you're taking and applying heat directly to the soil. Now you have the off gas that's coming up from that, so that you have the chemicals, they're then just in a different state, so they're vaporized then. And it's taken 30 minutes of contact with over 900 degrees Celsius. Now think about that for a minute, how hot that is and just what type of process that's going to take. And so with that 30-minute contact time, it's going to be a slow process, but it has shown it's proven to work. And then you have your traditional, like a pump and treat, to where you're just pumping the water through, and you're going to pass it through a granular activated carbon or a polyion exchange resin or high pressure membranes. But we go back to the landfills, because we have to dispose of this media after we run it through there. And so you have a lot of accumulation and a high concentration in these. So then you have to worry with disposing of those. And a lot of times this media is just left in place until we find an adequate place to dispose of it.
And the headwinds out there, you know, as you mentioned earlier, if PFAS were determined to be a hazardous waste, that totally changes, you know, the fate and how you would have to deal with those. That exponentially could increase cost to remediate these. Very difficult to remediate because it's hard to break them down. And a lot of times all you're doing is you're taking from an area where they could have public exposure, and you're moving to an area that's a little more secure where they can't get to the public as easily. Well, Jerry, this has been a great conversation. I hope our listening audience gleaned some nuggets out there. We're going to be tracking these developments very closely, have been doing it for a number of years. If you're interested in continuing the conversation, if PPM can help you reach out and research, any of these, you know, question concerns in regards to PFAS or quite frankly, any other environmental media, feel free to reach out to us at our website, www.ppmco.com. You can call us on our website. You'll find all our contact numbers. So, Jared, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Todd.
And before we say goodbye, is there any area in PFAS to where you could go and really kind of stay up to speed on the latest developments? Would you say EPA.gov is probably the best place to go to also get information on how this regulatory area is developing?
That's right. They are doing a good job of collecting all of the data in one spot, and they will also have links to different areas for different states and what is most up to date.
Well, Jared, it's been a treat. Thank you to our listening audience for tuning in, and hope you enjoyed the podcast. See you next week on PPM Simplifies. Thank you for finding our podcast. For more information, be sure to visit our website at ppmco.com. To stay updated on new episodes, feel free to subscribe to PPM Simplifies on your podcast app of choice. Until next time, this is PPM Simplifies.